You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Holly.
Hello, Bob.
How are you?
Good.
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, editor-in-chief of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You are Holly Elmore, executive director, I think, of Pause AI.
U.S.
Pause AI U.S.
Yeah, that's the entity that I'm executive director of. The movement is Pause AI.
Right. Okay. And and you would like to pause AI well beyond the U.S., I think. So, yeah. So, and also you do a Substack that is, I think, named after you. And
that's
so I guess
a lot older. Yeah, that's just my personal Substack. But sometimes put some AI-related takes if they're not exactly org takes.
Yeah.
It's
no, that's just
a sample
you.
Of what I'm thinking of. And for the last 2 years, this is all I've been thinking of.
Right. That's my sense. I've noticed that on your Twitter feed. So your Substack is, I think it's hollyelmore.substack, I think is the URL. It's named after you. And yeah, so I'm really excited about this because I have followed you on Twitter and I'm very impressed by your ferocity. Am I the first person to comment on that?
No.
Yeah. You're pretty intensely devoted to your cause. And I always admire that. Why don't we talk about your cause? So, as the name Pause AI suggests, you would like to, in some sense, slow the advance of AI and have all of us think a little more carefully about what we're getting into with AI. I don't know exactly. I mean, as far as what you actually would like to pause, I assume that is like large scale training of new models. Is that?
Yes. The original vision was pausing training runs past a threshold. So it was set at 10 to the 25, then 10 to the 26 floating point units, not units, floating point operations. That's what it stands for. So that kind of cut off. We've had a number of different ways of describing like exact proposals of pausing, but the idea is just don't push the frontier of capabilities until we have caught up on like what it would take to make that safe or to assess whether it can be made safe at all. I think it's possible that there is no way to have super powerful AI and continue to have human society or the things that we value. And there needs to be time to assess this and do the research and also for society to come to some kind of like reflective decision about what do we want our society to be, not even if we don't have like the worst AI risk outcomes come to pass, like catastrophes that like destroy civilization. We still don't want to just float into whatever future occurs, whatever, you know, when we build AI as fast as we can or make it crank up the power as fast as we can. We want to have the ability to choose the future that we want.
Mm-hmm. And so the AI, I guess you would consider yourself broadly part of the AI safety community. Is that the best name for the whole ecosystem of people who are saying, could we be a little more careful about this?
I like that name. Some people have gone for AI security recently. That's been kind of popular, like to distinguish themselves. kind of more of a like policy coded. There's always controversy with these kind of like identity things. I'd still say AI safety community to refer to basically everyone who's concerned about danger from AI.
Seems like the trouble with security is you could conflate it with people who are very like national security oriented, some of whom want to do the opposite of what you want policy-wise, I think, in some cases, right?
Like, yeah, that's why I consider it insufficient to, you know, certainly I'm concerned about security, but also other things.
Yeah, but I mean, they're like, at all costs, keep other countries from stealing our weights, which is fine, that's fine, but it points to a different set of primary concerns, I guess.
I like safety being the inclusive term.
Yeah. And so in the AI safety community, there's first of all a range of policy positions, and I guess you would consider actually pausing training to at this point be kind of at the near the end of the spectrum, right? I mean, because there's certainly a lot of safety people who are asking for less or less dramatic interventions.
Yeah.
And then there's a range of concerns ranging from the kind of some might say sci-fi end of actual AI takeover of the planet to, you know, like bad actors doing bad things or just, you know, the rogue AIs getting out of control. What is your set of concerns? Does it encompass the whole year? Do you consider it all kind of a possibility, including takeover or what?
Yes, it's full spectrum. And what I like about the pause position is it's a real policy. It's the outline of a policy, right? There are many versions that could be actually instantiated, but it's a real policy that actually addresses that whole spectrum. So kind of around like 2-3 years ago, there was a lot of heated debate between AI ethics, quote unquote, versus AI safety. So AI safety was taken to mean like big existential risk, and ethics was used to describe things like misinformation, societal harms, misrepresentation, things like that. And it's true, if you pick any given small policy or you think that you only have like 1 hour of bandwidth in all of Congress combined, then you might have to choose between what kind of issue which of those two camps you talk about. But if you present it as we need to pause, like the real problem is that these capabilities are increasing and we don't know what to do about it, and it's going to lead to all of these problems, like then the mm-hmm. position of pause is understandable and it covers that whole spectrum. So I think not only is it, I like pushing the position, and then I also think it's a good entry point for educating people on everything that AI can do, based because it's addressing like the issue, you know, for good or for ill, is that we're making more and more capable AI, and all of these things could happen as a result. And some of them might not turn out to be a problem. Some of them might be things that we can easily handle as a society by exerting our values or, you know, making a choice. But all of them right now are things that are like potentially going to change very rapidly and, you know, could catch us unawares.
Yeah. It's a funny thing about the distinction between the kind of AI ethics community and the AI safety community, to the extent that the distinction exists. Freudian slip. The ethics people, I mean, first of all, I would add to the things you mentioned, some things that some people would describe as woke. In other words, questions of discrimination and so on. But in any event, a funny thing is that a lot of people in the ethics community, for whatever reason, downplay the power of AI. They think its advance and potential are being overstated. And I'm not sure exactly why. Whereas the people in the AI safety community tend to worry that the average person does not appreciate how powerful this stuff is and how rapidly it's getting more powerful. You've probably noticed this, right?
Yeah, I believe like what's going on. For, this is a very common position also, that when we're out like handing out flyers, like asking people to sign our petition, like we get people kind of like asking this, like, well, isn't this all just hype? Like, when is it, you know, if we believe this, basically, are we like buying some kind of AI industry line? And I think part of that impression was created by Sam Altman being so associated with AI safety superficially before the board ouster. Although he really talked the talk. I mean, he gave it up and he clearly didn't mean it, but like he was talking about it the same way that, you know, the AI safety community was talking about it. And people, I think, rightly saw that he was a snake in the grass. And this is like how they interpreted it is, oh, what he's trying to do is impress us with the power of his technology or something like that. And he did later go to, you know, the US government and try to impress them with the power of his technology. So I think that that was not wrong. But I think unfortunately, like what they didn't yet appreciate is that he's not lying about the power that AI could have. I mean, unless something very unforeseen happens, like we actually do hit a wall with scaling training or something like that. Like it's just going to get more powerful and there's going to be more issues like this, whether any particular future that's sold to people is true or not, like the problem of the power of AI remains. But so I think actually that they were onto something, but unfortunately, like they didn't, it was still not like widely appreciated. Like we hadn't gotten through yet with that kind of education. I haven't heard that as much lately, and I think it's because people are quite impressed by the pace of AI. More and more people are aware of new breakthroughs that are
although there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago. And what's the, you would know then this woman, it's not Margaret Mitchell, but it's something like that, right? She was one of the stochastic Parrots people. I'll find this. Anyway, it was a piece that kind of did try to argue that this stuff is not moving as fast as people, kind of the Gary Marcus line, which I think Gary is sticking to. I would guess it's getting harder and harder, but I admire his persistence. So are you getting the sense that more people out there in the public are getting a sense for that something important actually is happening with AI?
The thing that made me start Pause AI was
You started the organization.
There's another founder, Joop Meindertsma, who runs the Pause AI Global, stuff, which is, different there. It's mostly Europe. And then there are some like country level orgs also in Europe. We were both calling our thing Pause AI and we met convergently. So I got to give credit to the rest of the movement. But yeah.
And then where does Liron Shapira fit in? He's been on the podcast. He's with your group or what?
I think he has a channel on the global Discord. And okay. that he does, he speaks at our protests in San Francisco where he lives. Yeah.
Okay, sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No problem. It's good to disambiguate. It's like a somewhat decentralized thing. And so I also want people to know, like, we want it to be tied to people's locations and have it emphasize like real in-person, events as much as possible and like protests. And we like people to know sort of what is the locality they should go to. But when I started doing my Pause AI that eventually like merged into the current Pause AI movement, it was because I saw polls and there were polls in reaction to Future of Life Institute's pause letter, which was asking for something different. It was asking for a 6-month pause. We're asking for an indefinite pause until it's safe. We'll figure it out. Basically, the default should be not going ahead until we know that it's safe to go ahead. But the poll that was a YouGov poll showed just crazy high levels of agreement to the position that like, of course you shouldn't go ahead if it's dangerous, like a pause seems like this AI could be dangerous. Like why wouldn't we should pause it instead of go ahead? And I don't think it was a very salient issue for most people answering that question, which is usually people's like rejoinder to hearing of polls like this. They'll say like, well, but they don't really care. Like they're not going to like, they don't think it's like the thing that's most important. And so they're not going to advocate for it or they're not going to base their votes on it or something like that. I think that was a great place to start because before that, the belief in AI safety had been, I would ask people like, why don't we try to like, talk more to the public about it? But they'd say, well, they'll think you're crazy and it just kind of blows your capital for anything you could have done. And I saw that reaction a handful of times, and it was enough to like make me believe it. But it was clear by the time of that poll. I mean, these answers, like various forms of the question, like would a pause be a good idea? Is regulation a good idea on frontier AI? We're getting like 70%, 80% agreement. And I thought like, this is different. Like, this is different than we thought. Like there's a huge opportunity here to, people are ready to hear this. Like, and of course they don't know everything they need to know about this. It's a new topic. I've always kind of like felt like I struggled to keep up with like what was happening in AI, like and everybody is, because it's not just a matter of the technology. It's also a matter of like, what does this mean for our society? Like, what do other people think about AI? Like, where are things going? It's an extremely tough topic. And I thought, here's the opportunity. People are open to hearing this and learning this. So I forgot where your question started, if you want to remind me.
Well, I was talking about, and by the way, I looked it up and the woman's name was Melody Mitchell. And I was actually kind of getting her mixed up with, I think someone's name is Margaret. So I withdraw the whole thing, but it is, it is an article in the Wall Street Journal where there's kind of a little bit of a downplaying of it. But anyway, we were talking about public awareness of the power of the stuff. You said it's possible that they'll run into a scaling wall. But as a number of people have noted, even if they did, I mean, even if the sheer magnitude of the training runs yielded diminishing returns, and I think there are actually signs that it is doing that. I mean, first of all, there are other frontiers of progress, right? I mean, the potential of multimodal is not fully realized, the chain of thought reasoning. And as people have noted, if you just stopped the large language models where they are and let people continue to build applications on them, you'd have a long way to go in terms of social impact, right? There's a lot of potential left to go. So, I mean, I'm definitely, I think, on your side of the general argument, which is that this stuff is momentous. And of course, I mean, one thing I'm taking more seriously, certainly than I was when I first heard about it, is, you know, when I first heard about the singularity, well, actually, I was never skeptical of the idea of an accelerating rate of technological change. I was skeptical of what was then a common view that the singularity would necessarily be this wonderful thing. That used to be more of a view like, we have no idea what it's going to be, but we're sure it'll be great. But it seems there is actually more and more evidence that the dynamic of a kind of self-reinforcing acceleration is starting to unfold, right? You probably saw this study that showed that if you measure the ability of the coding, the AIs that write code in terms of how long it would take a person to do the task they can now do, the length of task was doubling every 7 months. That was what they said last month. And then they added the latest two OpenAI models, and now it's doubling every like 5 months or 4 months or something. And that's fast.
Yeah. Right? I think you're probably referring to the METER study.
METER, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, again, this is something that we can describe easily, I think, to the public. Like, it's not hard to understand, like, if the AIs can like automate AI research into making AIs better, then like, yeah, like what is to stop them? Like if there's no human in the loop, then that can just, I think it's true. Like the we're creating what the original notion of the singularity was, like that is sort of out of human control. And it, like, what was the original notion of the singularity? But it was something about the self-reinforcing nature of it, right?
I think it's the first use of the term, I think, was maybe John von Neumann, but it was a kind of obscure thing. The famous use is Werner Vinge, the science fiction guy, who I think was talking about when the artificial intelligence starts to improve itself. And I do think you're already seeing AI progress accelerate the rate of AI progress because coding is such an important part of AI progress. You're not yet seeing the AIs just improve themselves without human intervention, but I think you are seeing a non-trivial.
By the way, I think that is the goal of, so Dario Amodei recently published another essay, and this time it was about mechanistic interpretability. I think that's what he's getting at. I think like he sees that as the next frontier for AI self-improvement, and that's maybe a way to get around, you know, the expense of training through, you know, intensive compute intensive training through gradient descent. I think they've got that in mind. Yeah, and that everybody's thinking about ways to like minimize the cost so they actually achieve takeoff.
Yeah, the I saw that speculation recently that one reason there's been so much progress in the coding ability of AI is that the labs, these several very competitive makers of frontier models, all of which would like to be the first to reach artificial general intelligence, whatever exactly that is, they want to accelerate their own research. And so they are paying special attention to the ability of the models to do computer coding. And, you know, you would say, I think it's safe to say that's the opposite of the kind of thinking we need, right?
Well, they used to put a safety gloss on that. Like, oh, the reason we're doing all these things are, you know, so that we can make sure things are safe, or we can like do like scalable oversight was OpenAI's last like big ambitious safety plan. Like app, it was the basis of super alignment, you know, was essentially like we can like each new level of AI will be like a bridge between humans and the next level, you know, explaining like what we want, what's good for us, that sort of like, and Yeah. And that was like when I heard a lot of these ideas like first pushed about. That's the first context in which I heard anyone from OpenAI or like in the like lab friendly part of AI safety talking about like AI, automated AI research, like the, in a way that wasn't like, hold on, like isn't recursive self-improvement like the number one thing we were afraid of and trying to avoid? But that's a good entry point to safety washing as a topic. So you mentioned that I'm fierce on Twitter. The one of the things I've been fiercest about and that I'm most opposed to like the rest of the AI safety community on is the idea of working with the labs. And this is kind of why this sort of thing. I think something that almost nobody appreciates fully is that all research into AI is dual use. So even if you think that you're doing it for safety reasons, you could also, when you learn something about the or you increase the capabilities of the AI, that's something that can be used for many purposes. And my assumption is that there are many, many, many fewer good purposes than there are bad purposes, just because there's many, many more ways to mess up a complex system like our society, like the conditions a human needs to thrive, than there are to get it right. So my assumption is that basically when we learn more about the topic, the bigger opportunity there is for capabilities to increase irrespective of how safe they are. And it's actually going to be very, very difficult and needs to be done under the right conditions. Safety research, research that really leads to the AI being built in a way that is safer or aligned if, you know, alignment is possible or a coherent concept. And so I'm very, very strong against, I think it's delusional, frankly, at this point to think that by being present in the room, so to speak, or by being at, you know, big labs and having access to their models, and even if it's to do research that like is itself like good and quality, I think like just overall the strategy of working with development with the labs, like the conditions are not right for that to result in safe research. So that's why I'm opposed to doing that. And that's something that's very unpopular. And so I feel that it's important, since I'm one of the few people who really says that, to like say that loud and proud and to push people. I think that there's a lot of people in AI safety who started working at frontier labs out of a concern for safety. And like in 2016, you know, back when OpenAI started, I also thought, why wouldn't we try to get, you know, people with a safety mindset into OpenAI? But just things have changed a lot, and a lot of people are kind of locked in, like this is their thing now, this is their career, these are the skills they have. And so it's tough. It takes a lot to pivot. There's still big pipelines in effective altruism and the rationality community that are aimed at getting people into AI research roles. And like those have a lot of inertia. So that's the reason for particularly that opinion. I think it's really important to push the internal Overton window in AI safety on the acceptability of working with labs. I think we got to take a step back. There was this idea that AI safety is a technical problem and we're going to figure it out, and we're going to figure it out before AI capabilities are a big threat. And that is just very outdated. And all it takes to be outdated in AI is a couple of years, you know, honestly. But, you know, when I was in grad school doing EA organizing, everybody was talking about like the doing AI safety work to prepare for like 50, 100 years from now, AI capabilities being a problem. Like they thought they were going to solve fundamental issue. They thought they were going to solve like the original Machine Intelligence Research Institute plan, which by the way, started as the Singularity Institute, you probably know.
Yeah, but now that is... Yeah, so that's Eliezer Yudkowsky's thing. It's funny, he was on my podcast back when this was called Blogging Heads TV, like maybe 15 years ago, and he was kind of in transition from somebody who had been super enthusiastic about AI to somebody who was becoming pretty worried, but wasn't yet a full-on doomer, I guess. So yeah, that started as, that was the Singularity Institute? Well, not started with, but at some point it had Peter Thiel money. And then, but I guess as Eliezer moved toward doom, he probably no longer had Peter Thiel's support, I guess.
I don't know the history of that. And I don't even know if Thiel is still involved, but I know that, like at least at the time that I like became aware of the whole ecosystem, like Thiel was still pretty active, like in the whole ecosystem. Now he doesn't like it. He doesn't like the doom perspective.
So, right.
But,
right. And can I just say, for people who don't know, I mean, our audience, my regular audience is not super deeply immersed in AI probably, but this kind of subculture that Eliezer Yudkowsky was a big part of, he started the blog Less Wrong after he had collaborated with Robin Hanson on Overcoming Bias, another related blog. But this whole kind of rationalism community, I've only recently become aware of how important it was in shaping a lot of thinking about this, including, I think, one thing you're kind of critiquing, which is the idea that alignment by itself can kind of save the day. Alignment, of course, refers to like figuring out how these machines work so that we can figure out how to align them with human interests and human values. And it's kind of a sheerly technical solution that, so far as I can tell, often doesn't involve due consideration of how far it is from being an adequate solution. In other words, like, okay, suppose you figure out how to align AI, but so long as like a bunch of people in a bunch of countries, maybe some of them doing open source, are making a bunch of different models, you're not going to be able to like impose your alignment agenda on everybody. So what happens then? I don't hear that much discussion of questions.
Well, one answer to that was a pivotal act. I believe Miri coined that phrase, which was the idea of like, this is back when Miri thought they were going to make the superintelligence themselves. And then they were going the pivotal act would be ensuring that nobody else could make superintelligence, like through whatever means, like the AI would tell them how to do it. And they'd make sure, you know, which would.
But wait, they were going to take
really
over the
world.
I didn't know Eliezer's original agenda was to take over the world, but apparently.
Yeah, nobody really talked about it. And what's funny is like, I heard about that back in the day. I wasn't focused on AI then. Like, and it just did not occur to me, like, to think like, wait, that's a coup. Like, you know, it didn't occur to me at all, but I guess I just thought of the entire thing as like sci-fi, like in my mind, even though I was like taking it seriously enough to listen to it and like rank it in like my considerations of how to help the world and all that. Like, but it still just like didn't seem real enough to me until 2 years ago. Really, the ChatGPT moment affected me, I think, the way that it affected, you know, so many people worldwide. I had more background knowledge, but I also like didn't think like this is really coming. I knew a lot of people around me, like Eliezer, I think the year before, had written this post called Dying with Dignity about how like it's over. And
for the species?
Yeah, like we're just going to die. And maybe in 5 years is, I think, what that, maybe the post doesn't say it, but I think that's what he was saying around that time. And a lot of people around me were saying stuff like, yeah, I stopped going to the dentist because of short timelines. I smoke more cigarettes because of short timelines. Like, and like, so people around me were at least showing that they believed it. But I always thought like, nah, that doesn't seem right to me. Even though like these arguments all make sense, or even if I don't totally agree with them, like what do I think is going to happen? Whatever it is like not good. It basically, if we don't make sure it's good, I'm assuming that it's not going to go well, you know, with really powerful artificial intelligence. But but even then it just didn't really like strike me like this is going to happen like now, like soon. We have to do something about this.
It surprised a lot of people. And I still think there's limited awareness of how, not just how powerful the machines are, how powerful just the approach that you're kind of the way you're it's not like you're building a machine that is the human mind. You're building a machine that almost reverse engineers the human mind, I think. And that's why I think there's no reason to think we're at the limit of what we can do, because so long as you can feed data into it that goes into humans and comes out of humans, I just think you can kind of keep going in principle. In fact, so this is a recent development. Like, this is an example of something you were ferocious about. I enjoyed this burst of ferocity on your part. It was this organization. So these people have been thought of as like safety oriented because they were part of, what was the name of the nonprofit that did
Epoch.
Epoch. And then two of them, And Epoch kind of measured things. They started this new company whose goal is to basically facilitate the automation of all human work. And I gather one thing they're going to do is more systematically gather the data, like at a workplace. Like, okay, you're a worker at an insurance company or whatever. Here's what you do. You know, you're looking at your machine and you're moving the mouse like this, and you're getting this data in and you're generating that data. I mean, I don't know exactly what they're doing, but I gather that the key to automating or a facilitator of the automation of various tasks is to really is to get all the data associated with the performance of the task, like what comes into the person's brain, what goes out, what mouse clicks go out, and so on. And then you can reverse engineer a machine that has the cognitive capability they exercise when they do that job, right?
Yeah, my understanding of what they're going to do, which they're not like, this is just based on like people, insiders, like telling me what's probably going on. It's like they were developing this benchmark, like they had this project, RL Workbench, that was like going to be a way to test how well models performed in like simulated, like real world settings. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the three founders of Mechanize, I think it's just Mechanize, their Twitter handle is Mechanize Work.
That's the name of the company, yeah.
Yeah, I think they just realized like this would be extremely valuable for training. And this is something like this is the area where AI fails the most as far as automating labor today. And like most of the frontier labs have their sights set on superintelligence and they're trying to reach like high IQs, and they're not necessarily trying to, and they're probably thinking they're going to get all of that stuff, like how to do today's like dishwasher, you know, loading kind of tasks like for free, like once they reach that high level. But but it's probably going to be extremely profitable, and who knows how it'll feed into, you know, super intelligence seeking to do the kind of thing that Mechanize is talking about. I think they just saw like a really amazing economic opportunity and like figured they'd take it. But this is a thing, this was a much more blatant example than I ever expected to see. But this has been an issue with evals and benchmarks with the models, is that they're becoming the things that the models are trained on. Like increasingly as we run out of enough just natural data to do the like searching a huge space, which is, you know, the gradient descent approach, which is what made like the LLMs. As we move on from that, like the approach is now to add reinforcement learning, which is you get a reward for solving the problem, and you kind of give, there are different ways to do with the training. It can be like, how well do you do on this test? And the test can be something that was developed as a safety evaluation or a safety benchmark. Like that can become like the main way to test, to provide targets for model for model training in the future. And so now there's a bunch of people who got into doing that for safety reasons, who are, they have a really valuable product and ability for training. And that's like a much more valuable use case that provides them a lot more money and prestige and temptation than using it for safety. I also think the safety case for evals and benchmarks is pretty lame at this point, because the original idea was like, we'll show government officials like how dangerous this is or how capable they are, and then like they'll kind of put all the dots together from there, like once we've shown them this data, and then they'll do something about it. I think now we should only do evals if there's some kind of regulatory consequence attached, because like otherwise the act of doing the evaluations is like doing free work, and if not work, at least promotion for the models for AI companies. I mean, there was an era with evals where people were like talking about it like it was sports, or like, you know, the horse race numbers or something, like, ooh, you know, like O1's like pulling ahead, but it doesn't catch up in this way. And like, and it didn't seem like there was much point to it. It was just like, but it was sort of something you could get credit for. And it was something that felt related. I think a big like spiritual cancer in AI safety is wanting to be close to like the level of prestige of the labs. And so like there are kinds of safety activities that keep you closer to that, like evals, you know. But they can end up, they very quickly become services for the labs. And with Epoch, right before this Mechanize it's not a spinoff of Epoch, but, you know, with this mechanized, you could call
it's
it
a
like
new
corporate
raid. Company, right? Like founded by two of the people from Epoch.
Yeah, they're just leaving Epoch. Yeah. But so it's not a spinoff, but it was they had this Frontier Math scandal. So they had a benchmark Frontier Math. It was a pretty cool idea. I don't think they would that like a lab would have been able to gather this data themselves, because a lot of mathematicians contributed problems that were like at the edge of their ability because they thought it was for like a charitable purpose. Mm-hmm. So it was like a set of like very, very difficult problems that like that mathematician did have an answer to. And so it could be checked, but they weren't at all in the data that, you know, the LLM would be trained on or the model would be trained on. And it turned out that that was commissioned by OpenAI and they wanted to have access to all of the answers. And
they weren't transparent about who was funding it?
No, they weren't. And it was, I think it was Tomei behind it, and Tomei is now leading mechanized work. So there was a whole scandal.
So wait, did OpenAI train on the data they gathered? Or
the take of the person I know best in Epoch and trust the most is that they didn't. They really did want to use it for, you know, to calibrate their model. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It was weird that they would insist on all the answers. It was supposed to be like a public benchmark. It was not supposed to be for a private. So there was a lot that was just like fishy about the whole thing. And then very soon basically, OpenAI is like hiring a charity to do benchmark work for it. I guess I'm not sure what the payment arrangement was, but it was like they were donating money for this to be made and they had certain expectations. So this was like a whole scandal that happens before. And then very soon after that, three people are gone just working on providing benchmark, you know, eval type products for industry to train on.
Automate work.
So there's just like I think there's like a very clear transition into, you know, like how you go from being like an AI safety research charity to people starting a capabilities firm, like trying to mechanize work, you know, and create job loss.
So your outrage was kind of twofold. I mean, first of all, there was a sense I got from a few people like, wait a second, we kind of thought you were one of us safety type people, or at least that was your ID. And now you're clearly doing things that will accelerate progress. And then the other one is just that, wait a second, this data you gathered as a nonprofit. I mean, there's a distant analogy. It's distant and vague, but between this and the whole OpenAI question, right? Started as a nonprofit, use that as an asset to attract great talent. Now you're moving into for-profit. Similarly, you're saying like, wait, some of the stuff, some of the kind of intellectual property or at a minimum insights you gained under a nonprofit rubric, you're now taking into the for-profit.
And there was a lot of, I don't know anything about the money behind this, but there was a lot of like very flashy promotion, which was a big step up in the production values from Epoch, which it always had a nice website for Frontier Math. And there was like, you know, a hot long feature with Dwarkesh Patel, with the three people who would go on to found Mechanize later. And that obviously Dwarkesh is an investor. So clearly that was.
Wait, planned. He's an investor in Mechanize?
Yes.
I assume he disclosed that at the beginning. I missed that. I listened to some of the podcasts. I mean,
I don't think he did because it was a surprise. Like Epoch, all of.
He was an investor at the time he recorded the podcast and didn't.
Well, I see. I don't know that, but he is an investor in Mechanize. So, you know, it's possible they put it all together the day before they announced it to everyone. But I don't know. he is listed as an investor in their announcement. But there was just a level of like production going on with Epoch and like sharing those results. And a lot of people in safety were like, like we're sort of getting the recognition we deserve. Like our thing is seen as cool. And then like immediately afterwards, like three people leave to start their own company with Dwarkesh as one of the main investors.
I didn't know. I mean, he's a fascinating subject in his own right because he's become this big influential podcast. I'd love to know how one does that, and I would do it. I want his training data, I guess you could say. Before long, we're going to go into overtime, which will be for paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter. But first, I want to give you a chance to like give your basic sermon. Like, what? First of all, let me say I really admire. So I gather when I've seen these like pause, like these people like in front of Anthropic, like shaming Anthropic workers when they walk in the door or something at one of these big. I assume you're like one of those people.
Yeah, I didn't get. There weren't many workers who walked past the door. They pretty much every time we do a protest, they're told to go in another entrance.
But I gotta say, I admire that because for one thing, I mean, let's face it, your numbers are not yet comparable to say Martin Luther King's March on Washington. It's not like you're leading millions of people, you know. But you have the courage to go out there and confront people for something you believe in. I mean, not physically, you're not abusive, but
very much nonviolent. Thank you.
Very nonviolent.
Giving me the chance to say that.
Yeah. No, it's impressive. It's impressive. But why don't you, or maybe I should frame the question is what appeal do you think you find kind of most effective with people who haven't yet started focusing on this question? Because I know that some people, maybe including you, take the AI takeover scenario very seriously. But that's a hard one to sell to people, I find. And once we get it over time, I want to talk about the challenge of, I mean, I'm personally like agnostic about it, but I can't find a reason to rule it out, you know? But what do you try to draw people's attention to if you just, you know, were walking up somebody on the street and you want to tell them like one basic thing about the future of AI as you envision it that should lead them to worry about the pace of advance, what would that be?
Generally, I find the average person already is concerned and thinks there should be intervention. It's generally that they don't know like one of five things. And one is they don't realize that the government is not regulating it already. Mm-hmm. So often people will think like, sure, it's dangerous, but you know, airplanes could be dangerous, but you know, we take care of it. They don't realize that the incentives are very messed up, that things have happened very quickly. The industry has gotten the jump on our legal system, which by design goes slowly and tries not to restrict people's freedoms to build things. So that's a huge one, just like letting people know, here's the state of things. Like, this is not your normal case of like, yes, like, of course, like there's growing pains with progress. There's reason to think this is going really fast. And this technology could be, might not have another chance after we see the first like serious consequences from it. Mm-hmm. I actually find that people, now that people are, especially in San Francisco, maybe, which is where I get my like opinions on the street, people are fairly open to the takeover scenario. They don't think it's as weird as I thought they would.
San Francisco is not a typical chunk of planet Earth at this point in technological history.
Perhaps,
is the greatest concentration of AI where people anywhere just about, with a possible exception of like Berkeley and Silicon Valley.
But our other cities that have, like local organization kind of report similar things that when you tell that generally they don't find people are that alienated by the idea. And whether, I mean, it'd be a whole fascinating like digression, like, you know, why it would strike people as weird or not. Like, but generally I think like, I think Terminator gets the general idea correct, you know, and that's been out there. Like there's just, you build a system that is like autonomous and it does it for some reason. It doesn't want to do what you want it to do anymore, or it doesn't do what does something you didn't anticipate you told it to do. You have a huge problem. You know, that's really all it takes to understand it. So I've actually been surprised how much people are open to hearing that. And then I also find that people sometimes they hear about the risk from AI, but they don't really know like how to calibrate like what risks we accept. And if we give examples like, you know, in engineering a bridge, like you're supposed to, the safety threshold will be like to like one in 300 million chance of collapse, you know, and like that is, and then we've got these CEOs from these labs saying that there's like a 20 to 30% chance of society like being snuffed out from this technology. And so like, that's the disconnect we're talking about. Like, but people, they've kind of successfully through the force of that rhetoric. And I think through, this was Sam Altman's intent, you know, with talking about P-Doom from his technology, like nerd people are just like wildly miscalibrated them to like what's acceptable. So the biggest thing that I want to provide through Pause AI is a sense of psychological like safety through the fact that like we are a community of people who we do hold this opinion that this is dangerous. There's a lot of fear, like people, they don't know what to think. And so, and they're like afraid they'll be wrong, especially like in San Francisco. And like tech circles, there's this fear of being like a stupid Luddite. And so I think that the most important thing we're doing to just ease that like first step is to create like a space where they can think about it. And I think there's a vulnerability in advocating a collective action type solution. There's a vulnerability. A lot of people, the number one response that I get when flyering is, if the person responds at all, is, it's a good thing you're doing this, but it's inevitable. And like, I don't think that that means in their mind, like there's a lot of positions that people hold that are not going to win, you know, but they still feel like it's the right thing and they push for it. And so I don't think the issue is really that they just looked at PAWS or international cooperation and thought like, well, that'll never work. I need to focus my personal efforts on working in a lab. Like, that's not what that person's deciding. Like, they're deciding sort of like, do I open my heart to caring about this? Do I like take a stand, even though it's actually quite, if I open my heart to this issue, like I'll see that like there's a lot stacked against me. Or in order for like the best solution to work of international cooperation, a lot of other people have to like also put their, go out on a limb for it, like emotionally, even just a little bit. I think that's like the best first thing that I would like Pause AI to communicate. And a protest isn't exactly what's going to communicate it. They have like a different goal, but like the existence of Pause AI, like the online space of Pause AI, doing more like chatty kind of like street interaction, that's what I would like people to get. Because otherwise, like in the AI space and in AI news, there's this sense that like, if you're not, I mean, I work full time on this and I cannot keep up with AI news. It's, yeah. If you're trying to do that, like industry will always like set the tempo. I cannot keep up with every technical development, and people feel like they have to do that in order to have an opinion. I think we like rapidly need to empower people to like, not only is it okay, it's like necessary that you express an opinion on this major development that's going to affect our world in these huge ways. And you can have the opinion that you have. And many people do think that the right thing to do is have international cooperation, agree to regulation, but they feel like as an individual, like they're not allowed to stand up and say that, yeah. But that's what it takes.
Yeah. I want to talk about that. So we're going to head into overtime, which
can I
again,
plug our website and where
yeah,
people
I'm gonna, I'm going to give you a chance to plug everything. Let me just first say that, so there's a link in the show notes if you want to go to Non-Zero Become a Paid Subscriber. And there's other, you know, of course, bonus content aside from the overtime segments of all the podcasts. But once you do that, you can set up your own podcast feed and the overtimes will always be there. I also want to say that once we get into overtime, which we're not going to quite yet, I do want to talk more about the international cooperation issue and why it's almost considered uncool, apparently, in AI safety circles to talk about, to express support for it. And I want to talk about takeover scenarios and kind of drill down on trying to like visualize how takeover happens and talk about some other stuff. But yes, first plug whatever you want to plug. First of all, what is your actual Twitter handle, your X handle?
It's my personal one is at @Ilex_Ulmus. So that's @ILEX_ULMUS. It's a pun on those are the botanical name, genus names for holly and elm. But I didn't realize that I was going to use it.
You think I didn't know that?
I didn't realize it's, now it feels a little inconvenient that I did that for my Twitter handle. and then the org has @PauseAIUS at Twitter, and our website is pauseai-us.org. And if you're going to do one thing, I would say to sign our petition, which you can find at pauseai-us.org/petition.
Yeah. And I would just like to say, by way of reinforcing that, that there's just a lot of different reasons to worry that this thing could go too fast. And I think one of the main ones, maybe I'll have time to talk about this in overtime, is just the kind of guaranteed social dislocation and upheaval that will result from rapid AI advance. That just seems to be completely guaranteed that we are going to start seeing disruption in the not necessarily good sense of the term on an unprecedented scale. And I'm just not sure society can adapt fast enough to keep bad things from happening. Just the sheer pace of change. So if you want to comment quickly on that, you can. Otherwise, we'll head into overtime.
I think the reason that it is uncool in AI safety is that it's the culture of AI safety is very libertarian. And that's just, I think that literally suffices to explain it. It's like, it's embarrassing to be like, oh, but technology will cause dislocations. You know, like people will be like, are you saying the Industrial Revolution shouldn't have happened? That was so good. You know, people were inconvenienced then. Like, people are always inconvenienced, like when things get better, but the pie grows and gets bigger. And like, it's kind of showing that you don't get that if you say something like, but there would be massive social consequences, or like, and so that was very unpopular to acknowledge. In fact, the first time I've seen a lot of these people say anything about social consequences is that 4.0, OpenAI's ChatGPT 4.0 is sycophantic. I've really been surprised that by that change, because disinformation,
they mean it's always saying, oh, good point, and oh, it's just like complimenting you and a lot, and being highly, highly sensitive to your psychological needs. I should say, like, at this point, I guess we are in overtime. We have made the transition. Let me amend those remarks. We weren't in overtime. Now we are heading into overtime. Thanks to everybody who's followed us this far. Hope you'll follow us the rest of the way.